It's basketball season and we've got you covered. The Ringer NBA show breaks down the latest and greatest around the league 5 days a week. Check out the Ringer NBA show on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Misok Kwonga, are you ready?
Am I ever ready? Okay.
Are you never ready?
No, I'm not. Hello and welcome back to the Stadio Podcast and Ringer FC. I'm Misok Kwonga.
I'm Ryan Hun.
Ryan, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Musa. How are you doing?
Tired, but good. I don't know why I'm tired. Slightly concerned individuals on social media going, oh, what is up with your sleeping patterns? The answer is I don't really know.
Sleep when you need, man. Sleep when you need.
I basically sleep about 4 hours a night, and I have done since the age of about 20. I mean, that's pretty much who I am.
A weirdo.
Yeah, that's a big vampire energy. But yeah, I'm good. I'm glad you're well. So what should we get into today?
Today we're going to be talking about the Champions League. Four ties from this week. We'll go through those. And we'll also touch on a little bit of the results of the She Believes Cup, which rounded up. And if we have time, we'll touch quickly on Barca beating Elche. And although it was a game you expected them to win, and I don't think it really needs too much diving into. Spurs beat Wolfsberger in the Europa League. They had their tie on Wednesday. Went through 8-1 on aggregate. Nice and easy.
Yep.
But a couple of bits of admin before we move on. Don't forget, if you do listen to us on a podcast app that allows you to rate and review, please do so. It'd be very kind. Wright's House this week, you and Carl were on. It was a really good episode, I thought.
I really enjoyed it. Great fun.
Yeah. It's a lovely listen.
The nicest thing about it is that Jesse Lingard saw the bit praising him and shared it. And it's really nice to know that stuff. That stuff really matters to players.
Yeah. Because really everyone's so mean. It's just like nice when people say nice things.
Yep.
Stadio Outros playlist. If you like music. That always, whenever I say stuff like that, it always reminds me, you remember the Harry Maguire World Cup meme?
Yes.
Someone's just like, put that picture and it just says, oh, I just listened to a little bit of everything really.
Yeah, you know, also, if you like music, it reminds you of people that used to sell their mixtapes down near like tube stations in North London. Like,
oh yeah, man.
If you like music.
Yeah.
But in a way, I rate that and respect that because it's like, you have to, right? This is before social media. So how else are you going to connect with people?
Yeah, man. That reminds me of like Market Street outside the Arndale in Manchester. Just random mixtapes always being flung. It was really good.
I love that.
Yeah, Stadio Outros playlist. If you never hang around until the end of the podcast because you've had enough, first of all, it's fine. We understand. Yep. Second of all, you're missing out on a different track each episode that we play
out
on.
That's true.
We compile them into a playlist on Spotify. If you search Stadio Outros on Spotify, you will see all of the tunes we play out with. The latest one is at the top. So if you want some music to keep you going, there's also the Stadio Sessions playlists on there as well of tunes that we use on the Stadio Sessions that are available on Spotify. And we need to do one of those soon. Sorry, we've not done one for a while. We've not done one this year. It's been busy, man. It's just this football, man. This football thing. It's a lot of it.
Yeah, there's a lot. There really is a lot.
Final thing. Hope everyone's staying safe, staying well. Staying as positive as possible. I really can't wait for the time when we don't have to say that as much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we know a lot of people are having a tricky time, and we hope that you're all hanging in there. And if you want to get in touch about anything, stadiofootball@gmail.com is our email.
Yep.
We have a load of emails to get back to. Apologies for those who haven't received a response yet. We try to get back to as many as possible.
I've got a few Instagram DMs as well, so if people have sent me stuff there.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Just those, a little humble brag there.
No, they're not like that. They're not like that, Ryan. No, God, no, they're not. Can I just know, like, for clarity, they're not Instagram DM slides of that nature. Let me clarify. Nothing of that nature. And one last thing of admin. I got an essay coming up on the Ringer, ringer.com/soccer about Pele.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
Pele's legacy. Yes. Yeah, so that's been written. That's coming soon.
Oh, and one final thing. If you are an Arsenal fan, I'll be on the Arsecast on Friday.
There we go.
Talking about, well, we're recording. This is before the game, we're recording this episode, so could potentially be talking about Arsenal's dramatic exit from Europe.
Oh gosh.
Stares into the distance.
Can I say though, not to self-aggrandize, but you know.
What are you doing?
I'd like a bit of praise because I haven't had any football hot takes on Twitter yet. I know it's only been 2 days into the week, but I think that's incredible restraint. So I think I deserve a little bit of...
To be honest though, I don't think the games have really given you much ammo.
Have I ever needed anything?
Hard to make a take hot when everything is so lukewarm.
This is true. This is true.
Well, on that note, let's go on to the football. If it's okay with you, Musa, I would like to start with Borussia Mönchengladbach 0, Manchester City 2.
Let's do it. Let's go there.
I thought this was actually quite an intriguing game because...
Tactically, yeah.
Yeah. Because I saw a lot of Gladbach hate online about their tactics, their performance. And I was like, did I watch a different game? Or maybe I'm just a big old softy. Because I think Manchester City were comfortable, put it that way. Mm. They were good value for the 2-0. But I think, if I'm right, in only 4 games this season have Manchester City registered fewer shots than they did against Gladbach. Intriguingly, 2 of them were in the Champions League, one against Porto, one against Marseille, and then the 2 games against Liverpool, I think are the only games this season that City have registered fewer shots at all, let alone on target. Now, obviously, shots per game isn't the ultimate barometer of how good you are. But
Gladbach made them work.
I think they did. And I think the thing that was frustrating, and I think the thing that maybe clouded the performance from Gladbach, was something I tweeted, actually, that Gladbach were doing this thing that sides used to do against Barca 2010-11, which was whenever they did get the ball, they treated it as if it was the last chance they were ever going to have to attack in the game, and therefore just panic.
Yes.
Like, I think... You know, if you think Gladbach had that chance, well, they had that opportunity at 0-0, which they basically did this move that Marco Rosa completely outlined in his pre-match interview on DAZN,
right,
where they basically switched it to the right wing, and then they had that ball into the middle. I can't remember who, was it Player up front on his own?
Player and Stindl. They were playing as a two, but maybe
they
were slightly more advanced.
But in that move, right, and basically they'd kind of got City running towards their own box. And if the ball was better weighted, Player had a tap-in or a one-on-one.
Right.
And it was under hit. Ruben Dias comfortably cleared it, or Laporte maybe it was. But there were also other chances where they got the ball and broke. Stindl mishit a couple of passes. Florian Neuhaus missed a couple of good opportunities. So in terms of, it didn't translate into chances created, but they did have opportunities to break, I thought. And actually do City some damage. And they just kind of panicked, I thought.
I feel like this is an interesting game and defeat for Gladbach because it's almost like, in quotes, a good defeat. Like, it's not a defeat you'll look at and be like, we let ourselves down. And tactically, this 3-5-2 is interesting as well. With Zakaria as a centre-back behind Kramer, so you've got like 2 DMs almost. So you get this, you've got this really great playmaking from the base of the team, which sets up, is actually really good for the counter. So tactically, it was interesting. And you've got those 2 8s, Hoffman and Neuhaus. And the bench was pretty strong too. Thuram and Mbolo. So Gladbach gave a great account of themselves. And it was weird looking at the City bench as well. I mean, I don't like to make it all about resources, but City had Ferran Torres on the bench, De Bruyne, Aguero, Mahrez, Fernandinho. Like, they had Stones. Like, they had an extraordinary amount of resources in this game. And this is not to denigrate City at all. It's more to say that this scoreline is about par. Does that make sense? It's about
I thought I think I just don't think there has to be one side was amazing, one side was dreadful in order to win a game of football, especially when you're dealing with two clubs that have such vastly different resources and squad depth and the value of that squad construction, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, could Gladbach have done better with when they did have the ball? 100%. But they also had that player chance in the second half, which was right before he came off, which isn't exactly a big chance, clear-cut opportunity doing a kind of scorpion kick behind or flick behind your head. But they did have opportunities to create quite good goal-scoring chances, and they just missed that little bit of calm and execution in the final third. Like, there was that one where they broke 3-on-2, and I think it was actually Zakaria ended up with the ball on the right-hand side. in the second half. It was like all of a sudden they started running in treacle.
We saw that. We've seen that. We saw that with Chelsea as well, actually. I don't know what to read into it. Sondheim seems just a bit out of sync. And I think it just speaks to the level of attacking coordination maybe that you need. Because Gladbach, actually, this is the sad thing for Gladbach, I suppose, is their greatest strength in this Champions League has actually been their attacking coordination. We know they've got it in them.
Mm.
Maybe there's a question of, you know, the Gladbach that was brilliant in the group stages is slightly different to the Gladbach that we're seeing now.
Mm.
A part of that is Marcus Thuram being in and out of the squad. I wonder how much actually that spitting incident derailed him and Gladbach's season, because there was a really great chemistry. And actually, if you look at the best attacking play from Gladbach in Champions League this year, he was at the heart of the bulk of it. And now you're playing as a team as complex as a City, and you've got to reconfigure on the fly. You've got, I mean, that the team that Gladbach put up against City doesn't have the same chemistry as the one that started the season.
Yeah, I agree.
It's all these tiny margins, Ryan. All these tiny margins.
Yeah, and I think also with Manchester City is that they do a lot of damage to you physically and mentally when you play against them, very much like Barcelona 2010-11. And it's actually as good as those Bayern Munich sides were that Pep managed. And it feels a little bit weird to say this considering that he's already won the league twice at Manchester City with record number of points.
Mm.
I think this Manchester City now is the most mentally exhausting Manchester City that Pep's created.
And it's as close to being
as mentally exhausting as that Barcelona 2010-11 side, because, and this kind of goes to what I was saying before about the Gladbach thing, is that trying to defend against a side that is that dominant and that fluid with the ball, but also that good without it, is so exhausting. That I actually thought the two goals that you saw Gladbach concede were a prime example of that, because they both ended up from being from clips, basically, or kind of, they weren't really switches, they were clips to the back post.
Yes.
From this kind of little pocket just outside the box on the left-hand side.
Yeah, Cancelo, yeah.
And that is actually, that is supreme elite attacking football against a side that is defending quite well in a block, I think.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
You find the pocket of space, which is what, maybe like a 2x3 meter space in the back, on the back post for the second goal. And you have a guy who's, what, 5'7", as the guy hanging on the back post, who then heads it back in Gabriel Jesus was marked as well on that second goal, and he did really well to finish it, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that is a prime example of maneuvering the opposition into a point, like you move them into a thing where they're focused on this attacking setup on the Manchester City's left hand side, and then they just hit you like this. It's a very, very overused analogy, but it is like being constricted by a python, because I think it can feel quite suffocating playing Manchester City in this way, especially if you're a side like Gladbach, who, as good as they are, they just don't have the players that Manchester City have, which isn't exactly a wild take. I think it's clear as much as we have a soft spot for Gladbach. And I think this is why I'm quite sympathetic to their performance. And I felt that the takes about Gladbach being dreadful, I thought, were actually quite harsh. If this Gladbach performance came against and no disrespect to them at all, but say an Atalanta or a Lazio, I could understand it a little bit more, because those are the sides that you would expect Gladbach to go a bit more toe-to-toe with.
Mm.
If they take the lead at 1-0 with a chance that if it had better execution, they really could have taken the lead.
Right, right.
I know I'm going on a little bit of a wandering rant here, but this is what makes it so reminiscent of that Barcelona side that I referenced, because when you get the ball against sides that are a little bit more on your level, you're like, right, our turn, let's go. But when you get the ball against a side like Manchester City or that 2011 Barcelona side, it's like, we're going to lose this in a minute. We have to do something. That's the instant reaction, and it's only against a few teams that you get that against.
You made a great point there. Well, a series of great points. The one thing I just want to add is, I think the most impressive about Gladbach's performance is they made City work hard for their goals.
Yeah.
If you're going to lose, make sure they score good goals against you. It's like when you're playing tennis, right? If someone hits a forehand winner, make them hit the line.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can't complain. Like, they hit the line, you know, I got beaten by a good shot. It is what it is. And they made City construct this victory. They didn't give it to them. You know, there's some other, you know, I would say actually, funny enough, if we're going to look at any team that would be disappointed across these results, that the four results we saw, I would say Gladbach are towards the bottom of who should be disappointed. I would say, you know, like maybe sort of more Lazio and Atleti should be disappointed, really. Lazio because their home form has actually been quite strong in Champions League at certain points this season, and Atleti because, you know, who they are and where they are. But Gladbach shouldn't be disappointed with this in terms of what they put out there. You're never happy to lose. You're never happy to lose, yeah. But you're not, shouldn't be overwhelmed. And also, to be honest, let's be frank, an early goal in Manchester and who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think Marco Rosa will be disappointed, actually. Yeah. I think he will be disappointed with how little they created with the few opportunities that they did have. I did say when I tweeted it, I was just like, they have had a few, they will have more.
Yeah,
you know, they had one. I think Hannes Wolf had that shot towards the end, which I think was the only shot on target that they had. But still, it doesn't mean that they didn't have the ball in quite decent positions. And I mean, the possession breakdown it ended up being 61% to 39%, I think, which isn't...
It's not awful.
It's not awful. No. And it was very much 60-40, 58-42 for a while.
Can I say something else? Pep's normalised that. Can I be honest?
Yeah, Pep has normalised
60% possession, because there was a time when that was a horrifying stat to concede. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, it's par. Mm. If that makes sense.
Yeah. There were a couple of situations that I thought it just showed you how unbelievably good Manchester City are. When they didn't have the ball, they switched into this hyper-compact formation. It looked like a turbocharged version of Space Invaders. And there was no way that there is any way through this. And you could see Gladbach kind of freaking out a little bit.
Unless you play over it and you won't get the ball back. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then Gladbach, I think, actually did that. They tried to clip it. It went straight to Edison. It zoomed in on Edison. And then it cut back to the wider pan, and all of a sudden, Manchester City had scattered. I was watching it on my own, and I actually let out an audible, like, I went, wow. It was like that. And I think that this is the thing that I'm saying, like, I don't really understand what people would expect a Gladbach to do in that situation. The only thing that I was disappointed in a little bit is that I still believe that Gladbach are at their very best when they show a complete lack of respect for the opposition.
I agree.
They did it in the first half against Inter. They did it in the first half against Real Madrid.
Yeah.
It's a massive high risk, high reward strategy. But I do believe that this Manchester City now knows that so much of their advantage comes from a mental, almost like a mental shadow over, over the opposition. I wonder whether the way to sting this Manchester City side now is actually to fly out the blocks at them and basically be like, you give it absolutely everything for the first 20 minutes. And if we get something, then we sit.
Look at Leicester, man-marking Rodri.
They're so not used to teams flying at them now.
Yeah.
Almost being so afraid of conceding that I do wonder how a Manchester City side would respond if, for example, they were just swarmed for the first 5 minutes.
Yes.
Now, obviously, actually executing that is a lot harder than suggesting it. But that was the only thing that I kind of hoped Gladbach would do. But when
have the players for it.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I think they could have gone really full. I mean, now they have to do it in the second leg because they have to score, and they have to score more than one.
Right.
So it'll be really interesting to see how they do that second leg. But overall, I think Marco Rosa will be disappointed with the lack of quality in a lot of the stuff they did with the ball. But I think the plan wasn't, I don't think it was that bad.
Yeah, I agree.
What was bad, however, was Pep's coat.
Oh my goodness. It looked like fancy dress, Ryan.
I mean, I tweeted that Pep looked like he's nipped down the shops for some milk. And then, but this was before, because I missed the first clip where he turned around in the first 5 minutes.
You didn't see what I saw.
I didn't see the back of the jacket for the first time until after I tweeted that. And I was just like, okay, I've just seen the back and I've got nothing. I mean, he took the jacket off and Man City got a lot better. So I don't know what that says.
I mean, I think it says everything.
I think both of the goals came Ona Yaka, as they would say in German.
Yes, yes. Well, there was a thing when they asked him, you know, City doing so well, and he talked about, like, we have the resources to buy all these players. And I was like, with Pep, there's always that little barb, like, where Pep's whole thing is basically at this point, we're not going to get credit, no matter how good we are. which is going to win stuff, are they going to take it whether they like it or not? And that's kind of Pep's thing at this point. I think he's in a phase of his career which we've never seen before. He's been at City, you know, for an unprecedented period of time. I think he's quietly happy there because he's got all the tools to make the football he wants without the scrutiny of Barca. And I think if you had the Barca type fan base, if you had the amount of ex-Man City players in the press, and if you had the same size of fan base, this City team would be a lot more celebrated, right?
Mm.
And he knows that. And I think there's a part of him that's like, I'm annoyed I'm not getting more credit, but screw everyone else outside this club. Not in a kind of like actively screw them, but like, I'm really not bothered by anything but the employees, the supporters, and my squad. That's just it. There's a weird thing with Man City where they're almost like, it's a strange thing that happens with them when they're at their best, where people almost look at the league table and it's like, they see everyone below them. It's a consistent thing with City. Like for the last few years, when they've been at their very best, they almost like just evaporate from the discussion. You know, when they're just out there hammering teams 4-0, 5-0, like putting on these actual exhibitions, these clinics. And it's partly because their resources. Yes, it's partly because their resources. It's also because they create this numbing effect. They're so good that City at their best create a numbing effect. And like they're doing it again now where you look at them. I mean, look, Zinchenko was on the bench as well, and he's been brilliant for them.
Yeah. It's the Python thing, man. It's yeah, this like the right. Slow suffocation. And the more you wriggle, the more, you know.
It likes it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, man. Always watch Atalanta.
Yes. Oh, this was a funny one. Okay. So they lost 1-0 to Real Madrid at home.
Mm.
And this is a interesting place that both clubs are in, both teams are in. So Atalanta, you could argue from a distance, football historians will look at this and be like, oh my goodness, Atalanta played Real Madrid in the, you know, the knockout stage of the Champions League. This is arguably the biggest game in the history. It's a huge game for them.
Mm.
But the weird thing was, what those historians will not see immediately at first glance is this was not the Champions League as we know it because of the lack of crowds. This was not Atalanta as we know it because Hatabo was missing. Hapo Gomez has been sold. You know, Ilicic was on the bench. And this was not Real Madrid. You have any Real Madrid where Isco is starting as a false nine is not the Real Madrid that we know, right? And this is, you know, injury and management. And Real Madrid's bench was absolutely threadbare. And Real Madrid actually are kind of, they're a bit of a white walker at this point, a sort of sentient zombie that just keeps advancing. You know, despite all efforts to hack them down, Real Madrid just keep advancing. And that is credit to, in particular, Luka Modric and Casemiro, I would say, above all, who drag Madrid through so many games, and Toni Kroos to a lesser extent. Atalanta, this entire game basically turned on that red card.
Yeah, so, I mean, what?
Awful, awful, awful decision, in my opinion.
I thought it was a really bad decision, and he was extremely keen to give it.
I see. Well, it's when I say awful decision, I also say that with a bit of sympathy because it's the kind of choice that happens. It's like when you're, it's such a silly example to use. You're on holiday somewhere and you haven't got much time. You're going to go sightseeing and you're like, I'm going to go to the old part of the city as opposed to this bit. And you go somewhere and it's terrible, but you were like so focused on going to that bit and you were so kind of like concerned with, I've got a limited amount of time to get this right. And you're refereeing a huge game at Atlanta Real. You're refereeing a Champions League game. And at some level, you're like, I'm going to make my decisions and back myself on them. Because you can only make a decision like that and back yourself if you've made a choice before the game to just be like, I'm going to be decisive. I'm going to be decisive. When you're surrounded by massive players all going, I think you've got this wrong. But the referee's just doubling down at that point. Now, so situation comes, you know, so Remo Freuler cuts across Ferland Mendy, who was running through on goal near to the box and was given a straight red for denial of a clear goal scoring opportunity. Now, whether Mendy would have scored, still had plenty to do is another question. But the referee obviously felt the need to make a big decision at that point. And unfortunately, Freuler was the loser and Real were the huge beneficiary.
He was also moving away from goal.
It felt a bit like, this sounds a bit uncharitable, but it felt a bit like, I've got to be decisive. It felt like a bit, I've got to be decisive. I've got to get this right. And it was painful because they were already up against it, Atalanta, to a certain extent. But that was still a Real team that was there. You know, Hatabo was a huge loss, but that team was still there for the taking. We've seen Atalanta dismantle teams far less accomplished than that Real team. And you look at that and you're like, well, the the decision beat us, and you saw Atlanta try to like generate some form of attacking momentum. They still had good pieces on the pitch. You know, you've still got Zapata there and Muriel, who haven't been slouches this year. They've been fantastic for long stretches, but you're a man down. And the thing is, a midfield that experienced against 10 men, eventually it will draw the sting. Mm. And Casemiro, Kroos and Modric just basically shut them down after a certain point. And credit to Isco, because he made some nice little pockets of space. You talked about pockets against Gladbach that City made. He operated really well, could have had one or two goals. Laid the ball off beautifully in that false line role for Vinicius, who could have scored, should have scored maybe.
Mm.
And Real only really got out of jail with a very late and beautiful winner from Ferland Mendy with his wrong foot. So
lovely goal.
You know, Atalanta were very atypical in this game because defensively they were really accomplished.
Mm.
They held out for, 70 minutes with 10 men?
Yeah.
And that's not an Atalanta that we've seen in this Champions League, or indeed in the last two seasons for the most part. So really have a lot of sympathy for Gasperini. But what I would say really is Casemiro's out the second leg.
And he could have gone, actually.
Right, yeah, he could have gone.
He could have gone. And I saw a funny tweet, I think it was from Kevin Williams, actually, who obviously is not like Kev to say something spiky about a Real Madrid player.
Especially Casemiro.
Exactly. Yes. And he was just like, the ref went to book Casemiro and then saw it was Casemiro and just gave him a stern warning because he was already on yellow.
But he's a huge loss to them.
He's a huge loss to them. And if you saw the players that Real Madrid were bringing off the bench, like they haven't got a huge amount of depth at the moment, actually.
Not at all.
So, yeah, I don't think this tie is anywhere near over.
If I were Atalanta, spiritually, I mean, I am, I'd go full Atalanta in the first. You talk about going for full Atalanta for the first 15 minutes and try and blow them away.
Because win 5-4.
They could get some joy. Win they could get some
four.
Joy against them. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that would be a hell of a tie because there weren't a lot of goals this week apart from in the Bayern game, but even that didn't really feel like there were a lot of goals in.
Yeah, and if there's any team that you'll back to go all in, a goal down and away goal down and Champions League tie, it's them.
Yeah. What did you make of the Ilicic sub on, sub off?
I have no idea what's going on there.
I mean, did you see his interview with Marker? There was a thing in Marker about him and it seems to, like, it shed a little bit more light on his absence from the side. So the headline from the interview with Marker is, I was afraid of going to sleep and not waking up again.
Oh my God.
And there's a line in there where it says, those who know him say that the Atalanta forward is an extremely sensitive person. His life changed when he was diagnosed with lymphadenitis, an inflammation of the lymph nodes, which made him fear the worst. In his memory was Davide Astore, former teammate of his at Fiorentina. They played 63 games together and he died in 2018, resting in the run-up to a match. And Ilicic says, in those days, I thought a lot about Davide. I was afraid of going to sleep and not waking up, not seeing my loved ones again. And the images of trucks full of coffins, the almost constant sound of ambulances in Bergamo, the strict confinement measures and the death figures all began to really affect Ilicic, who felt he wasn't able to play when football came back. And that's why he was given permission by the club. Atalanta basically gave him permission to go back to Slovenia. And Gasperini said that he's a recovered player now. But I think that we kind of knew that something was going on with Ilicic. And I think that this might be the first time I've seen it laid out in that much detail. But, I mean,
so do you know what? Credit to Atalanta. Yeah. Credit to Atalanta. It's taken so long for it to come out. Do you know what? That club has really taken care of that player.
Yeah. I mean, they really protected him.
Yeah. They took care of that player. Like, they lost. Him and Papu Gomez were two extraordinary playmakers. They sold Gomez because he fell out with Gasperini. They didn't force Ilicic back into action, didn't throw him under the bus, didn't make any public comments about, oh, we expect more from our big players. None of that, which we would have seen. We've seen that from, you know, other clubs, other managers. So shout out to Atalanta for that. And to be honest, with the players they had on the pitch, they had the tools to get it done. But of course, this isn't really about football. The reason I want to mention this is the She Believes Cup. Obviously, the football itself bears analysis. Same time, the wider context, the fact that Japan pulled out and Argentina went in because of the coronavirus. Things like this, like this whole pandemic, and it's a bit of a kind of like, you know, we've talked about it 1,000 times, but every now and again, the pandemic reminds us there's such a human cost to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a human cost. The spectacle that Atalanta put on in the Champions League last year, Ilicic scoring 4 goals against Valencia, and that happening in an empty stadium, and Atalanta being on the best run in their club's history, like playing astonishing football.
Mm-hmm.
And that was robbed from them because of this pandemic. And the fact you've got like key people, key protagonists, you've got protagonists like Ilicic in this whole Atalanta drama of the last few years, you know, in many senses, just too traumatized to take the field or to perform to their best ability. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And, you know, my attitude has been like rather like yours as well. We're just lucky to be getting this at all. Football has definitely helped me from a very selfish perspective. Football has helped to fill my evenings and just remove that kind of extended isolation, because without football, the evenings just kind of go on forever, really, if you've got nothing else to punctuate them. So again, I just want to say, like on the record, like my gratefulness for players for even providing a spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, when you actually read the interview or the article in Marca, it makes you realize that even though we've suspected it all along and we've constantly said players are being asked to do things that they've never been asked to do before, how many other players have suffered
like that? Yes, yes.
And I think that personally, I know we've got a couple of other games, we've got Tuesday's games to do, but I have wanted to kind of talk about this for a while.
Mm.
Okay, so quick disclaimer at the top of this point. I know that there are financial reasons here, and I know that clubs involved are usually reliant on the money that games being broadcast provide.
Yeah.
However, I think that UEFA, maybe the leagues as well, the individual FAs, but I put this more on the kind of the regional or the continental confederations. I genuinely think what they've done here is borderline criminal. The reason I say that is because they could have still got football done this year.
Yeah.
They also could have done it in a way that showed that they actually give a shit about the professional footballers that they rely on for their product in order to sell it.
Yeah.
For example, as soon as this huge wave started coming back, well, essentially it was a third wave in Europe in October, November.
Yeah.
European group stages were done, right?
Yeah.
The thing that I believe they should have done was, okay, is it wise when there's a vaccination program being rolled out to have multiple squads in multiple European competitions plus international friendly fixtures traveling around Europe during a third wave of a pandemic when most of these countries are in lockdown? No, it's not. Is it fair to put the players through that? No, it's not. So therefore, how about we use the fixture dates that would have been taken up by the European games and give them back to the domestic competitions so we can bring the end of the domestic seasons forward?
Yep.
We reduce the amount of travel that all of the clubs have to undergo if they're in Europe. We've said this before, that the domestic competitions have done a really good job on the whole of reducing the amount of COVID cases.
I agree, yeah.
It seems to flare up when international competitions happen or international fixtures, generally speaking. Why don't we allow the domestic competitions to use those, and then we will program the knockout stages of both the Europa League and the Champions League for mid-April, towards the end of April, and we will do it in one location again. Because that actually, if you like, how exciting was it when we had
great
Champions League knockout games every few days in
great
like
format.
A mini tournament.
It worked. Yeah.
It was brilliant, I thought, in terms of a spectacle.
Yeah.
And then also you're giving players more rest because they're not having to travel to Bucharest from Manchester for their home games or whatever it was. Now, where did Manchester United play? Turin. Gladbach traveling to Budapest.
It's absolutely wild.
Like for a home game. For a home game.
Yeah, a home game. Yeah, traveling that far.
This just isn't fair. I know a lot of people will say, well, the clubs want the money, so they've got... No. And I'm really sorry if this comes across ranting. I'm really sorry if people disagree with it, but I genuinely
believe that.
And I've said this a million times before, that like you don't have to have either or in football.
There's balance, right?
There is a balance there. For example, like none of us are naive enough to kind of say, well, yeah, modern football is pretty gross and wouldn't it be great if it was better? But there's a reality at play there that has to play out. However, how refreshing would it have been if you had the head of UEFA being like, right, we understand that their TV companies have bought this and we need to fulfill the fixtures. However, player and staff health and safety is a priority for us. And therefore, we believe with consultation and cooperation with the individual FAs that we will halt the European competitions until April, because we feel that by then a vaccination program would have been sustainably, would have been rolled out a little bit further down the line. Potentially, each country may not be in as severe lockdown as they are now. Maybe travel might be a little bit more understandable by then. And also, we reduce the amount of travel that players will have to do ahead of a European competition in the summer. But there was never any of this. It's like, no, figure out where you're going to play your home games.
Mm.
The thing that really just annoys me about this, and I'm really sorry again for going on a rant. But
no, go for it. I agree with it. Go for it.
Distinct lack of a shit that anyone gives about the players in this scenario.
Yeah.
I genuinely believe, and it's like I wrote in that tweet the other day, I really believe that in a few years, if somehow this all goes away, that we will look back on this and be like, what the actual fuck were we putting these players through? And cases like that, like Ilicic, are a prime example of this. And he will not be the only one. And there will be a lot of people, there are a lot of young players who are living on their own in countries that are not their native countries, and they may not speak the language. And they've had to do all of this whilst achieving the absolute maximum elite level of professional football and being absolutely torn apart for a shit performance on Twitter about it and all of this kind of stuff. I really do believe that UEFA have completely failed in their duty of care here, in my opinion.
I completely agree with this. The only thing I'll add to that, I look at Alisson Maximan and what they've experienced at Newcastle with long COVID, and I wonder to myself, how many Newcastles are there? How many footballers are suffering with long COVID but hasn't been disclosed? I think what Steve Bruce did was really, it was wonderful he put that out there because it brought everyone back to reality. Long COVID is so dangerous. The way that that affects you long after you get it, and it affects people. It's not just about underlying conditions. It affects people who are prime of health, fully healthy, could not be fitter. There are a few athletes on earth fitter than a Premier League footballer. And you see what it's doing to these people's livelihoods. It's a debilitating condition, illness that for a lot of people never goes away. For a lot of people, it kills them. Now, look, personally, I wear two masks, Ryan. I wear two masks. I wear the surgical one and the cloth one over the top. From the moment I leave my front door to the moment I get home, I do that. I've been doing that for the last couple of weeks. And before that, I wore a mask from my front door and back pretty much for months on end, right? Now, that I'm someone that like works when I'm listening home, and I'm in a state of alert in relation to my health. You're a footballer. You're out there training. You're opening your lungs the entire time. You're going in and out of airports, confined spaces, and you know that long COVID can destroy your career potentially, or it could kill you. That was what we've normalized. The duty of care thing is you're right, it's absolutely UEFA. It goes wider than UEFA, but UEFA is almost like in football, it's the emblem of that.
I mean, for example, I do not think that any respectable football fan, if UEFA had come out in December and said, in light of the COVID situation in Europe, we will postpone the Champions League until the domestic seasons have been completed because we feel it's safer for all. We can still complete the competition. We will play it as one-legged knockouts in a neutral venue. Even if they play two legs to fulfill broadcasting slots and money. I think a lot of people would have been like, whoa, holy shit. It's a natural
flexibility.
Forward thinking. And, you know, wow, they actually give a shit about this. And they understand that they have to fulfill these broadcasting fixtures or broadcast slots, but also they're showing a genuine care and interest in the health and safety of players and club staff. I just think it's frankly wild with the fixture pile up that you're being asked to travel to countries sometimes 800 to 1,000 miles away to fulfill a home fixture. It's just, but being honest, man, if I think about it a little bit too much, and obviously we do a football podcast, so we have to talk about football, like it makes me upset thinking about it. And I do think that sometimes it's just like the show must go on no matter what. And actually, no, it fucking doesn't have to.
Agreed. Well said.
So then, after that, should we talk about the other two games that happened?
Yeah, no, let's do it. Let's do it quick.
All right, let's quickly start with Atleti Chelsea because, oh God, I think this was such a... Atleti were on a poor run of form at the moment. and Simeone had kind of let them go a little bit, and it was really good to see. And now it strikes me as that he's kind of caught a little bit between fully letting them go, but also noticing that this stuttering run of form, I think, is maybe thinking about him switching to type a little bit more. But I think that because they've changed slightly how they've played this season, I don't think they're as able to do classic Atleti as what, like the Liverpool game last season, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they're as able to switch into that mode as they have been in the past.
He's such a funny one, Simeone, because overall you're like, this guy's doing a magnificent job. And then every now and again, you see a specific game where you're like, you are severely undercoaching these players. And when it comes to that specific game, it's like, it's all about attacking coordination. If you have players of the quality of João Felix, Thomas Lemar, Luis Suarez, Niguez Llorente, if you have players with those tools, you can blow teams away and still have defensive solidity. Like, sounds an awful comparison to draw, but imagine what Pep would do in an attacking sense with that configuration of players. They'd be blowing teams away. They would be. But it's what has happened with Atleti, and this is in Simeone's defense, is the level of intensity and defensive coordination you need makes it very hard to switch that mindset into an attacking one. It's not that he doesn't know they can play that style. It's like, how do I get them to transition from attacking freedom to defensive solidity? It's very, very, you're right, it's very hard. And so what you have here, Atleti were very unambitious against Chelsea, and what really saved them against Chelsea for long periods was that Chelsea were just not playing into the final third very well.
Yeah, this was very much like, if you look at the stat breakdown, it kind of looks like basically every single game that Chelsea have played so far under Tuchel. Yeah. You know, loads of possession, outpass the opposition, not a huge amount of big chances created.
Their final third passing is not good. They played as if they were passing downhill. You know, when the pass gets hit and then just rolls away, in a positive sense. You know, Mason Mount has really advanced his case very well. He seems, you know, arguably could say he was probably like Tuchel's favourite player. Strange thing about Chelsea is it's one of the few players who's playing exactly in the position he wants to.
Yeah, but also I do wonder whether the lack of final third cohesion, let's say, comes from, because if you actually look at this Chelsea lineup, even though they're passing teams off the park a lot of the time, if you're going to switch back to say like a 4-3-3,
yeah,
now with the kind of the amount of possession that Chelsea are used to having, the way that they're playing the ball around, having people like Havertz and Pulisic in the final third will allow, like, I don't know, I still think that even though they're passing teams off the park, this Chelsea lineup, if you looked it on paper, it looks very much like a counter-attacking team.
Yeah. That's fair.
Maybe apart from Giroud, maybe because Giroud is, you know, a good forward pivot, but it's weird, I think. And I do think that ultimately Chelsea are improving under Tuchel. I think that they may not be unbelievable to watch, but they're extremely hard to beat.
Yes.
Still unbeaten under Tuchel. And I want to shout out Callum Hudson-Odoi actually, because I thought he was really good on Tuesday. And I thought that defensively he was really good. And he seemed to have really taken on board what Tuchel said on the weekend,
actually. I think Tuchel only treats a player like that if he's a favourite of his. I think he I mean, he loves Hudson-Odoi.
We said that as soon as he arrived. We were like, he's going to love Hudson-Odoi. And we said he'd love Tammy Abraham, and he loves Tammy Abraham because Abraham's like, Tammy Abraham's limping and he's on the bench still. You know?
Yeah. I mean, Tuchel, he's got this challenge where it's like, you know, to put in the Fugees lyric, is too many MCs, not enough mics. Too many attacking players. There are too many. Ryan, they're just the too many. And we could be in for a big shock. It could be Game of Thrones style. You have like a big shock casualty. I wonder who the big shock casualty is going to be from that group of attackers, because someone amazing is going to have to fall off.
Yeah.
And the thing that we know about Tuchel from his history is he's not afraid to have the big person fall off. Yeah. So this is for other clubs, they need to be ready to catch. If it's Ziyech, if it's Pulisic, they need to be ready to catch whoever falls out of that configuration. Because they're going to be some tasty treats coming out of the Chelsea tree.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, sooner rather than later.
I agree. I mean,
also Giroud, gorgeous goal.
Olivier Giroud, man. So disrespected. So disrespected. Everyone tries to get rid of him and everyone ends up turning to him.
A great goal, an astonishing strike. And the juice was taken out of this goal, firstly by the lack of crowd, but also by the VAR. Review of this.
Yeah.
Gorgeous strike, and he was great against Sevilla as well. A really good attacking piece, but the problem that Giroud has, of course, is that people want to see the new look Chelsea attack working with all the shiny new toys, right? All the shiny. It's like when Christmas comes around and it's like you can't wait for your presents, and you've got presents you've been playing, you've got toys you've been playing with for 3 years, but you're like, oh, but I want what's in the parcel. I want what's under the tree. And he's kind of always struggled with that, Giroud. I mean, I don't know how much he entirely cares at this point, because he is an extremely beautiful man who's very well paid to play for great clubs and has a World Cup winner's medal. So, you know, and insofar, I think he's good. I think he's good. But I think there would be a little bit of maybe a frustration of just not being entirely appreciated. But those who know, know.
Yeah. So Chelsea take an away goal into the second leg against Atleti. Atleti have got to improve, man. They have to improve, because
they're in a tailspin. They're in a tailspin at this point.
They're on a very poor run of form at the moment, and they're in danger of throwing away what was looking like a really, really, really impressive season.
Yeah.
Should we go to Rome quick? Lazio 1, Bayern Munich 4. Weirdly, considering it had the most goals of the week, I think this is the least intriguing game of the week. Bayern really didn't have to do much. Lazio were pretty poor. Made a number of errors that led to Bayern goals. The one thing that I would say actually that's impressive from Bayern is that they're very under strength in terms of depth at the moment. However, I think that they were gifted quite a number of opportunities from Lazio. I mean, if you look at three of the Bayern goals came from Lazio errors.
There was one, I mean, I'm going to sound a bit cruel here, but there was one part of this match I found hilarious. And it wasn't because the Lazio player scored an own goal. I'm not going to laugh at someone's own goal, but it was the fact that Alphonso Davies was so clearly living rent-free in his head when the square ball came across. And you see the state of panic that he induced. That is only the state of panic that can be induced when you know that one of the fastest players in world football is somewhere behind you. And you see the ball come across and he looks behind him like once or twice. And it was like watching a car chase, and you know that person's gaining on you, right? You know how quick they are. And he was just looking over his shoulder, left, right, and then like the apex predator is somewhere there and you've lost him. And then he basically like puts into his own net, and almost, was he even relieved? In the vast depths of the Olympic Stadium, was he relieved that the pain was over to score the own goal? Because then it meant that Davies had to stop chasing.
Just like...
existential own goal.
Done. It had to be done.
Exactly.
Like getting rid of the ring, man.
Exactly. If you look at his face, contrast his face with the face of one of those hobbits at the end. But bless him, like, because Davies was absolutely magnificent in that first half. He was superb. And you see what he gives. You see him coming in off the flank, and there's been conversations about Davies being out and Lucas Hernandez being instead, and like other fullbacks playing that Alaba to an extent or other options. But no, full flight Alphonso Davies is the biggest problem from the left back position in world football. It's the biggest problem. Like, no one wants that.
They really couldn't deal with it down the Bayern left hand side. Lazio. Was it for which goal was it that Patrick basically flicked the ball on the counter attack?
Yes, and he came.
Was it that goal?
Yes, on the halfway.
Is that the one you're thinking of? Was that the own goal? No, that wasn't the own goal, was it?
That was in the first half. So the own goal, second half. But the first half, you're right, when he comes off the flank.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a lot of sympathy for defenders at this point, right? Because fullbacks were scary enough and they were going outside, but now they're coming in like Cancelo and Davies. Like, can you not? I feel like just saying, guys. Do you know what? Like, this was bad. You know, you did it to that guy. Who was that poor guy that played right back for? Semedo, the Barcelona.
Yeah.
You did that to Semedo, but at least you were on the flank, but now you're coming infield.
Mm.
And this was the thing that Leroy Sané was criticised for, actually, at the international level for Germany, but also for City. There was a criticism that he didn't play in the interior enough. He didn't cut in enough.
I thought he was good on Tuesday, actually.
I thought he was very good. He's been decent, actually, quite a couple of times.
The last couple of games. Who was it? Was it the goal against Eintracht, actually, Lewandowski's goal? He just sat three Eintracht players down, some of them twice. And he kind of did the same thing on against Lazio, actually.
I'm a big fan of like big performances and losing matches. It shows a lot about, I mean, Hansi Flick will have seen the Eintracht performance and been like, that's the Sané that I want to see. You know, Bayern again are the team to beat in this tournament alongside City. I mean, City are marginally better at this point, but Bayern and City are kind of by themselves, aren't they? In terms of teams putting together either a run of form or having peaks that are identifiable.
I think PSG are in there.
That's interesting.
I think PSG are in there because if you look at the players they've got yet to come back, and
Di Maria, Neymar, yeah.
And Neymar, yeah. And Juan Bernat, which will give him a little bit more defensive stability.
Ooh, PSG, I think it's good shot.
I think it's Bayern, City, PSG, and you know what? I think it's Liverpool, actually. I think Liverpool, Van Dijk back in training. Van Dijk being back in training is like, you know in the WWE when someone looks out for the count and the ref lifts up their arm and it's down once and it's down twice. And posting Liverpool admin posting pictures of Virgil van Dijk back in training is like when the referee has lifted up for the third one that's going to get them out. And it's just like, oh, and then all of a sudden the comeback's on and they start doing the whole like, oh shit, he's back, oh my god, oh, and then it's like over in like 30 seconds, he's pinned him for three, what a comeback, oh my god, that's what that is, that's sending up the signal being like, oh, Liverpool fans everywhere are just like, it's back, we're gonna win the league and the Champions League and everything like that.
I'm already in my nuclear bunker. I'm already hiding out.
But you know what, though? I'm genuinely happy for Liverpool fans because they really just needed it. I think you posted, did you respond to the tweet being footballing thirst trap?
It's footballing thirst traps. Yeah, it is.
It's true. But like, my God, does Liverpool need something like that? Like, it's like when like Thomas Partey back in training for Arsenal, I saw it and I was just like, clutching a cushion, just being, this is one solitary tear going down my face. Yes. Just like, I've missed him. Like a new signing.
Yeah.
He is a new signing and he's already like a new signing because he's been out for so long.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's Van Dijk being, you know, on the mend is obviously huge news for Liverpool, which is great for football as well. Because you look at the squads that were turned out for this Champions League and you always want teams to have the best players available.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it's not a full spectacle, is it? So yeah.
Before we wrap up on the Champions League, Jamal Musiala started for Bayern and scored his first Champions League goal, and he is not yet 18.
Lovely goal.
He's going to be next level, you know. He's going to be absolutely next level.
Beautiful player. Beautiful player.
Very quickly, let's talk about the She Believes Cup.
Yes.
USA beat Argentina 6-0. Thanks to two from Megan Rapinoe, goal from Carly Lloyd, Christy Mewis, Alex Morgan, and Kristen Press.
That team looks scary, Ryan.
I mean, they are, aren't they? They just are. They won the tournament, scoring 9 goals, conceding none.
They look like an Infinity Gauntlet, actually. I was like, this is a full hand. This is a full fist of jewels. You see that and you're like, they're assembling.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think this Brazil beat Canada to finish second.
Yeah.
Having only lost the USA. I think this Brazil side are emerging quite nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, the USA are just... they're still the best team in the world.
They are. And maybe there was almost an element of demonstration, the comments from Rapinoe as well,
mm-hmm.
about putting pressure on not only other countries, but her own players. Like, you know, joking around going like, you know, Nines need to take care because I'm here scoring goals. But there's almost like an element of the, not to use too many cross-sport comparisons, it's almost an element of like a Golden State Warriors attitude. Like, don't take us for granted. Like, we're the best. And it's not easy being the best all the time. And we're not going to get tired of being the best. This is the thing. Golden State Warriors never got tired of dominance. They just lost players.
Mm.
And this US women's team is not, they're not getting bored anytime soon.
No. Let's wrap.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
We may have to record Monday's show a little earlier than usual.
Mm.
So we may do part of it as a mailbag. So keep an eye on @Stadio on Twitter for the call for questions. Don't forget to check theringer.com this week because it's video game week. I think they're down to the final four of the old, like the video game GOAT character bracket.
Goodness.
I saw an amazing tweet that the Ringer NBA put out saying, who would be your starting five in terms of video game characters, like point guard, shooting guard? And a load of people just responded, Steph on 2K, Shaq on 2K. Your piece going up this week on theringer.com/soccer. Go and check Wrighty's house if you haven't already. Do we need to shout anything else out?
I think that's it. That's it.
We are playing out this week on Abimus Mind by Nightless. We hope everyone's staying safe and well. Like we said at the top of the show, keep positive if you can. I know it's tricky. Anything to add, Mutua Kwonga? Any conspiracy theories you want to peddle this week?
No, we're all good. I thought I'd give the people a week off from my usual ramblings and rantings.
Are we in post-truth now?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Post Truth is something called Truth School now. Truth's back in.
Have a wonderful weekend, everyone, and we'll be back on Monday.
All good. Take care.